What in God's Name is in Summer Replay. Please enjoy our top conversations from this program year. If you have ideas for interesting guests, for future shows, drop us a line. We are always and ever grateful for the ways our listeners support our work. You can support our work by leaving us a review. You can join our roster of donors at patreon.com and get on our mailing list at whatingods.com. Today's show is a conversation with Leif Seligman, a professor at a New Hampshire State College. She shares her observations about the psychological and spiritual challenges of the young people that she teaches and learns with. During the conversation, it became clear to us that we needed to talk to some of those young people directly. So today's show will be followed with a series of conversations with three young women who were good enough to take the time to share with us what life is like for them in these days. Today's conversation with Leif was recorded with live participation from our Patreon supporters. If you want to receive exclusive invitations to participate in future conversations with our amazing guests, become a Patreon supporter of What in God's Name at patreon.com. Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shana Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We are using the lenses of moral philosophy and theology to see more deeply into our shared common life, getting beyond the usual lenses that we use, which are partisan, political, and economic.
Neither of which really helps us get to the deeper conversation concerning human flourishing. And that's what we're about. We're about staying curious. We're about going deep. We're about shining light. So, friends, welcome to this 26 and a half minutes of What in God's Name.
We have a special guest with us today that Shana will introduce in a moment. We also have, as part of our live conversation today, a special supporter of What in God's Name, Sarah Ellis, who is with us. Shana will introduce our interviewee at this point.
So what I want to say about my friend Leif Seligman is that I hope all of our listeners have a friend like Leif, someone who you really look forward to having deep conversation with, someone who makes you smarter just by virtue of the fact that you get to have conversations with them. Leif is an itinerant preacher, an author, a teacher, and a big, big advocate for restorative justice. Leif and I have known each other for many years. I have wanted to get Leif on the show for quite some time. And an opportunity came up recently when we were having a conversation. I had managed to convince Leif to come and preach at my congregation in Milford, New Hampshire. And we were talking about an incident or a couple of incidents that had happened with the young people in Leif's class. It happened to dovetail really well with the series that Chris and I have launched into about, the underlying impact of a sort of a deep sense of nihilism that seems to be overtaking our nation. And so I invited Leif to join us. So Leif, welcome to What in God's Name. It is so great to have you. I have to say I'm going to have to cavil a little bit because you're like my friend, and I'm so excited, you know, that all these folks will now have a chance to hear you and to get to know you, and makes me feel even just a wee bit prouder to call you my friend. So welcome aboard.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and that was a very, very gracious introduction, so I'm going to try to live up to it.
Yeah, well, I you won't have to work that hard, I promise. First of all, before we get into the show, I asked you before the show how many books you had authored, because I knew of two of them, but there's three of them. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about each of the books and with the, like your quick soundbite on each one?
Oh, sure. So it's sort of two and a half. But so one is called A Pocketbook of Prompts, and it will fit in your shirt pocket. So it really is a pocketbook of prompts. It's a book of writing prompts, and I begin every class with a prompt. Just, you know, it's a way to build community, to get to know each other. And over the years, I would come up with a question or a query, and then I started asking my co-learners. So I call the people I work with co-learners because we're all learning together. So they're not students, and I'm not the teacher. So we're co-learners. And out of that, I just assembled prompts and wrote a bunch. And so I have a pocketbook of prompts, which is kind of a fun little book. So that's one. The other is a book called Opening the Window, Sabbath Meditations. And really what it is a collection of 32 sermons, but my late mentor, Jack Spong, the Right Reverend John Shelby Spong, who blurbed the book and taught preaching, said, whatever you do, don't call it a book of sermons. No one will pick it up. No one is interested in sermons. So he said, call it spiritual essays. And I said, Jack, I'm a writer and I know what an essay is. And a sermon is a cousin to an essay, but it is not an essay. And he said, anything but sermons. So I decided they were Sabbath meditations. So that's the second book. And the third book is a collection of linked short stories about a traveling carnival in the Jim Crow South circa 100 years ago, and that's called From the Midway, Unfolding Stories of Redemption and Belonging.
Well, I have availed myself to two of the books, but I am unfamiliar with Pocket Full of Prompts, so I guess that's one I'm going to have to look at. Run out and buy as soon as the show is over. So, Leif, if I could, or if we could, begin where our conversation began. I love the notion of co-learning, and in order to bring everyone into that circle and into that conversation, could we go back to the conversation that we were having about your students, your co-learners, and if memory serves, you begin each class with a prompt. We call this in youth group highs and lows, but you have another distinction for it.
Right. I ask, do you have any tender spots? Do you have any exuberances?
I love that. Tender spots or exuberances. You asked that, and what kind of a response did you get?
Right. I think that's really what gave us the idea to invite me on. So I would teach in a couple of times a week, and I had two different classes. So we're talking about 38 or 40 kids. They're mostly first year college students. And so what I began to notice was a pattern that the one thing I noticed in the fall semester for the first time ever, on the very first day, every single person had a tender spot. Now, I can tell you in the past that was really unusual. Mostly kids would say, yeah, I don't have a tender spot. And then maybe 6 or 8 weeks in, they'd pause and actually notice whether they had one before they'd say, nah, I don't think I have one. And sometimes they would have one. But everybody had one. And it started with like a group of young men sitting in a row and, you know, saying, my tender spot is that I really miss home. I miss my family. I miss my dog. And the other question, do you have any exuberances? So I would say, do you know what that means? And I'd say, you know, are you excited about anything? And what happened was day after day after day, these young people would say, I'm not excited about anything. I have a tender spot, or my tender spot is this. Yeah, no, I'm not excited about anything. And the only exceptions literally would be, I guess I'm excited for the weekend. They'd say that on a Monday. And then they might say, I'm excited that I can go back to my room now and take a nap after this class. And finally, I would, you know, after weeks of this, I said, my tender spot is grief that you all aren't excited to be alive, that you're not saying that you're excited to be in college. I mean, or that you're excited that you're working on some social justice project, or you're working on anything, an art, you're making a paint. And they just sort of looked at me. And I think, Shana, that's what started that conversation you and I had about this sort of sense of nihilism, like that they just feel so disengaged.
So, I remember when you first told me that, you know, my mind starts to always wonder, you know, what is behind something or what is under it. I don't know if that's seminary training and, you know, all that thought to discern, but do you have any thoughts about what undergirds?
Well, I think for me, what undergirds it is, you know, in asking, I had a lot of conversations with my co-learners last semester, just to sort of get at what was going on for them. And they were pretty clear about, I mean, this is my phrase, not theirs, but they didn't disagree when I said, the kids are not okay. And, you know, young person after young person would say, they would talk about their trauma. They would talk about how most of them have ADHD, and that makes learning challenging in an environment, you know, in a college environment that is not overly responsive. It's adaptive. And this is something I was just thinking about yesterday. The college, just like K through 12 schools, make adaptations and accommodations. But let's think about what it's like to always be the person who has to have a setting adapted for you. That doesn't feel good. It suggests you aren't normal. The world isn't made for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's underlying part of the disengagement, is a constant message. The world isn't made for you. And these are, and then if you overlay, of course, in a larger sense, race and socioeconomics and class and gender and all that stuff, it layers on a whole nother, you know, bunch of stuff. But I think part of it was that. I think part of it, people talked about that they had just tons of stressors in their lives, that they had family stuff going on, that people are ill in their family, that they have work and they have schoolwork. And then there's the existential, like, climate crisis that they're aware of, but it's just too much.
Mm-hmm.
They're aware of the discord in politics. They don't vote. That's another thing I want to say. I asked how many of my co-learners would be voting in the November midterm elections, and the answer was none. And when we went around, it was like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect me. I can't be bothered. I don't want to spend an hour driving back home to vote. Even the young women, when I said, hey, what about reproductive freedom? It's like, yeah, I care about that, but what good will it do?
Wow.
Look at what's going on. They just, and then the other thing that they said was, I wouldn't know enough about who to vote for. I'd have to do research. And it was kind of like, well, it's not that hard to research. You know, candidates have web pages. I want to be clear. I don't think it's that they don't care about the world. I got the sense that they felt the world doesn't care about me. And I got to look out for me. Not in a way of everyone else be damned, but just in a way of, I got to take care of me. And one of the things I asked one day, one of the prompts was, what would your 80-year-old self tell your 18-year-old self?
Good question. Good question.
Yeah, and several of them said, co-learners said things like, my 80-year-old self would say, pay more attention to what makes you happy. Stop trying to please everybody else.
Hmm.
My 80-year-old self would tell me probably I shouldn't have stressed out so much about the grades I got. You know, they knew they had the wisdom in their bodies, but they don't have permission to listen to the wisdom in their bodies. And so I guess I would say, I think that's a lot, you know, those are sort of qualities that undergird what looks like disengagement, which looks like nihilism, which looks like apathy. I don't think it is. I think it's a response to feeling like, does the world care about me?
Wow.
That's my best guess. I have enough humility to say I could be totally wrong.
Of course. We could always be wrong. Chris, I'm going to throw it to you in just a minute. I just want to ask one more question if I can. Since this all kind of, didn't start last fall, but the time frame that we're addressing right now was last fall, and that would have been the first year sort of returning to school in a, and I don't know how else to call it, a quasi-post-COVID reality. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about, you know, did COVID play a role in any of this? And if so, what?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think COVID did play a role. I think it played a role in terms of, you know, folks feeling exhausted. In the fall semester, the young people were not required to mask, whereas the previous year they were. So they had mask fatigue, you know. I think that they had fatigue from being in quarantine and not being quarantined. The year before, they had to have weekly testing, you know, COVID testing. I think that they had been sick. A lot of them had COVID. They had family members who had COVID. They had roommates who had COVID. I think their high school years, the last year of high school for them probably was interrupted. So they were the generation, the cohort that probably didn't get the prom, didn't get the graduation parties, which to them matters. I mean, those are, you know, rites of passage. So
More to the point, I'm wondering, did anybody bother to like engage them in some conversation about that? You know, which would be one of those indicators that, yeah, the world in fact does care about you, the whole of you, like, hey, this is hard and it's really scary and how are you doing, you know?
Well, and I can tell you that when I taught a year ago, so spring semester of 2022, the co-learners I had felt very clearly that the world, and more specifically the college, was not paying attention and did not care and did not see them as whole beings. And I think that was reflected in the conversations we had in the fall as well. And one of the days, one of our classes, I'll just say, we went outside. It was a really unseasonably warm day, and we went out and we had a grief ritual. You know, and I talked to my co-learners about the importance of grief and that, of course, we all have grief. And I think that a lot of them could identify that they were carrying that kind of unspecified grief about the last few years. You know, I mean, a few kids could identify a relative who passed on, but others got like, yeah, there's just this heaviness in our bodies.
And just, I mean, just for clarification purpose, what was the course that you were actually teaching them that was the background to this conversation?
Well, in the fall, I was teaching a course called Restorative Reckoning, which is technically a course called, well, it's technically a course that's called Integrative Thinking and Writing 101. And anyone who teaches the course creates a course title and course content. So the Restorative Reckoning was a course that invited the co-learners to reckon with the world and what matters and to do it in a way that would be restorative. So that was the context. And the class I taught in the spring was also about restorative practice. So,
oh, that just sounds so yummy.
It is.
I'm feeling like I want you to offer the course for adults, and I want to sign up.
Yeah, you're not the first adult who said that, so it might happen.
I'm sure.
Excellent. So I feel like I have this vision of concentric circles, Leaf, which is you've had these conversations with your co-learners. What is your exuberance? What are your tender spots? And then from there, you had a conversation with Shayna. So I feel like that's the next ripple outward. And then now we're able to have this conversation together about your conversation or expanding the conversation. And then we'll put this out as a podcast and others will be able to participate as well. So that's just an observation. And I'm grateful. That's the final thing to say about my little image of the concentric circles is I'm grateful to be able to be part of one of those concentric circles. I want to ask a question that is intentionally aiming to be provocative. And I'm going to frame it this way, which is, I wrote down the quote you got from the young people that you were with, the world is not made for you. Maybe that's not a direct quote, but the sensibility, the world is not made for us. We don't, you know, it's an alien place. We don't belong would be other ways to say that. And so isn't the wisdom or isn't part of the wisdom of spiritual traditions that we inherit is this kind of sense of human beings are, in a sense, alien from the world. We're in it, but we're not of it. Our true home is somewhere else. So that's one observation. Like, is it special to feel that we don't belong? That's the first kind of observation. And related to that, your question to the young people, what would your 80-year-old self say to your 18-year-old self? I should follow more my own inner self and be less responsive to the expectations of others. That doesn't seem necessarily too different to me about how I might have felt as a young person. So
So what I'm trying to get at here is, what is special about now? Like, if these kinds of questions, if these kinds of feelings aren't necessarily new or different in terms of the human experience, feeling like I don't quite belong. I mean, that happens. Feeling like I should follow my own inner self. I'll just ask it again. What's different about now?
Welcome to my world, Leaf. This is the stuff he pulls on me weekly. Just comes out of left field with a question that's like, this is a great question. I have absolutely no idea, you know?
Right.
Hang in there, buddy. You're doing just fine.
Well, first of all, you can reject the question. Like, you can reject the premise, which is one way to do it.
And you can take time to think about it because Chris gets to edit this afterwards.
Great. Well, you know, the first thing I thought of, Chris, is you were asking, I think it was part one of your question. You know, I know you all talk about deep spiritual matters. I feel like I should offer this disclaimer that one of the things I say to the people I am in learning community with, and they don't have to agree with it. You know, it's not something I'm trying to impose on them. But one of the things I talk about in terms of being restorative is understanding our relationship, that we are of the earth. And so I guess that's a premise of yours that does not float with me. So I would say I am not on the earth. I am the earth. That my cells are co-constituent cells with all of you and everyone listening. And so we are all earth. And I think Sally McVeigh has a beautiful metaphor of the earth as the body of God. It's a metaphor. I like it. So I guess I would say that I think that doesn't answer your question, though, about why now, what's different throughout time, blah, blah, blah. I don't know that it is different. And I don't think that that makes the issue less pressing, because I don't think novelty particularly matters here. You know, so we might say for however long there's been human history or people sitting around having podcasts, there have been people who feel like, well, yeah, how come things aren't really focused on my needs? I think part of what's critical, though, is there is a connection. If we don't see ourselves as part of the body of Earth, it's like if my big toe is super sore and I can ignore it for a while because I have things I want to do today. But I mean, if it really throbs to the point where I can't walk, then I got to go, wait a minute, I have to attend to this. So everybody on this call knows that the climate crisis is absolutely existential. It is real, and time is a ticking, and it is different from when any of us on the screen were at college age. What's happened in the last 30, 40, 50 years is radically different and irreparable, and we all know it, and the young people know it. And they know that we have left this for them. And that does change everything. You know, so I think that's part of it, and I think if those young people feel like I'm part of Earth and the Earth is on fire and then I'm on fire, then it becomes a different issue to say, is anybody noticing that I'm on fire? And I feel like, you know, that was the metaphor I used with the young people in my class. I said, I feel like the world is literally on fire and the college is asking you to make a grocery list. We're supposed to sit in this classroom, and I'm supposed to teach you how to write an APA-formatted research essay, and the world is on fire. And when people's houses are burning in California, they're not going, do I remember the difference between MLA formatting and APA formatting, and what would be the appropriate font? And by the way, how do I know that I haven't plagiarized? No, they say, can I get my loved ones out of the house? And so I feel like that feels like part of what's different in a way that also one could argue, there's always been peril. But I do think that planetary peril feels different. And also, the other thing I want to say, I don't know if this is relevant, Chris, but one of my colleagues' co-learners said this to her, and it really stuck with me, and I asked my co-learners about it. This cohort of young people have grown up with active shooter drills in a way that none of us on this call have. So this is the generation, they are post-Columbine. So their entire lives, they're 18, they are post-9/11. So all they know is there were three mass shootings this last weekend in California, right? All they know is a kid could walk in my classroom and blow me away. They went through COVID. A kid could walk in the classroom and give me COVID and I might die, or they might give me COVID that I take home to grandma and I might kill grandma inadvertently. There's a level of risk and threat that I think does change it changes the flavor. I'll say that. I get that there's been risk and threat always in being human. But I think that part of it is that, and then remember, we've got, these are digital natives. These are indigenously digital people. And so information travels in a nanosecond. And that also makes, I think, a difference, because they can look at the world in a way, and relativism is completely different for them. What is their situation relative to, you know, an Inuit person in the Yukon? What is their situation relative to someone in New Zealand? What is their, you know, they can have access to everybody's lives. So I also think that changes the dimension of what you're saying about, well, so what's novel about this? I'd say, well, maybe on one level, nothing. And on another, those things feel different. You know, their exposure to this time in history relative to mass shootings, to violence, to the threat of a pandemic, and to global warming, which is a euphemism.
Leif, thank you for that answer. I found that helpful to me as I aim to think about this with you and with others. And the one thing I just want to put a star next to that resonated with me was your when you were describing the sense of burning versus the message about how to properly format your essay. And to me, and again, probably not new in the history of the world, but that deep sense of incongruity between the urgency I feel or the reality that I intuit or the truth that I know versus the official line from outside, you know, from the powers that be. I mean, that kind of tension can be very disorienting. I found that really a very, very interesting observation, and certainly an indictment on we who are supposed to be the adults in the room.
Well, Chris, now you've had my classic Leif Seligman experience where, you know, it's almost like you're walking around with a stuffed sinus and then suddenly your sinus opens up, you know, and there's you know, this whole new way of thinking about it. Because I was kind of thinking down the road you were thinking down, you know, just sort of like, so what's different about this generation? And I really appreciated, Leif, you're coming back to this notion of our interconnectedness. Because in fact, if the earth is on fire, then we are on fire too. We, you know,
right.
If the earth is at risk, we are at risk. There's no
separation.
You know, there's no parsing that, yeah.
Which makes sense though about nihilism, right? Because if you then go, the reality is I'm on fire, not just the world's on fire, I'm on fire, that would be hard not to need some level of disassociation to get through the day.
Correct. Yes. Yes. Just to get through the day. So, and as you were talking, I was sort of thinking about, like, I'm wondering if there's a risk for these kids that at some point, because the earth is on fire, therefore everything is on fire. And is there a way we can help them to start sorting some of that out so that they're able to take some control, experience a sense of control about, you know, some of it? I don't know, throw a lifeline. I don't know if you've given that any thought.
Well, I think I'm trying in that, you know, I'm certainly not wanting people to feel despair. And I don't find for myself that that's productive or constructive, you know, to walk around. So really what I've come to for myself, and I think my co-learners, actually I said this 2 days ago, you know, to a couple of new folks who just joined the class, I said, I don't feel like it's necessary for you to get 4 credits, you know, academic credits, to be stressed out and burdened. You could be tapping into sources of joy and get 4 credits for that. And I think for me, that is, it's my own personal answer to say, I need to stay connected to the sources of joy, which is not about a kind of embrace of hedonism and I don't give a crap about anybody else at all. And couldn't be further from that. You know, it's super tied to tikkun olam, the repair of the world. And I think part of how I repair the world is Howard Thurman, right? The world needs more people who are alive. What makes you come alive? Go and do that. And so I'm feeling like that as you talk about the folks you are interacting with, I think there is something to helping people, even if the help might be the wrong word, companioning. I like that word, to companion, to offer some warm accompaniment. And maybe what I can offer, what we can offer of a certain age, you know, I'm kind of trying to inhabit what it means to be an elder, not as an old person, but as and someone who's gained some wisdom. And to say, okay, maybe what I can do if you want is I could give you some ideas about how to create a container. Like, so class become, we co-create a container with each other. And I don't do it for them, I do it with them. And they appreciate a little guidance, and then I can step back. And so I feel like there is something to people, certainly I'm aware in social justice movements, in racial justice movements, people understanding the importance of joy, not necessarily as resistance, because sometimes joy, just people want joy to be inherent and not in response to domination and suppression. But I think about joy. Yeah, how do I connect with the deepest sources of my joy? Because the world is on fire, and it's not either or, it's and. There was another mass shooting this weekend, and I'm looking out my window and noticing that there's some exquisite trees that want me to acknowledge them. I have a bowl of soup before me that plant beings gave their lives for me to have this bowl of soup. I'm going to honor that. I'm going to savor that. So it feels like that's the thing. You know, even Viktor Frankl said, you know, find meaning where you are, no matter what's surrounding you. So I feel like that is important, and that in that joy becomes a container. And so if I can help people create a space of joy, and what brings me joy and what brings me meaning, what brings me delight, that's kind of the breathing space. If we're going to stay with the metaphor of kind of peril or fire, is if I can go into those places and breathe in some joy, then I can go back out in the world and exhale it. And while I'm exhaling it, I'm not breathing in the toxicity. Does that make sense?
It does, and I'm really grateful for your reference to our need to be effective meaning makers, just something that Chris and I have talked about fairly extensively. And, you know, once upon a time, you know, some houses of faith did a pretty good job at teaching people how to make meaning. And of course, with the decline in attendance at churches, you know, the question then becomes, okay, well, where else can folks learn to do this? But clearly your classroom is one place. But where else are young people going to learn how to make meaning? Because, like, that for me is the key. That is the thing, the ability to make meaning and to know how we choose to respond to something is going to come about based on a narrative and some choices that we're going to make. We're powerless about a great many things, but we're not powerless in terms of how we respond. And I worry. I worry about our young people because I don't know where they're getting that these days. You know, I don't know who's telling them that, in fact, they do matter. And who is companioning them in this task of making meaning in a very difficult time where, you know, when I was younger, when I was in college, yeah, we had stuff happen, but it happened at a different pace. You know, you actually had a chance to make meaning of it. How do you make meaning out of 3 mass shootings when they've happened less than 24 hours apart from one another? You know, it all is happening against the backdrop of all this other stuff. You know, it's just this onslaught of information that it feels overwhelming to me. And I'm an older person who's been on the planet for a while and has had some practice at this. So, yeah, it makes me very concerned for them.
It's a great question you're posing. And I guess that might be the charge to anyone listening who has the energy to ask the question with you. Yeah, where do they go? Where are those spaces? Because I'm thinking about just what you said. So when I was a young person, I started college quite young, but there was, it was during the era of whatever, I guess maybe the third iteration of feminism, but there was a political community, there was a feminist community, I could have those conversations. There were adults who took me seriously as a young person, who valued what I had to say, who were there for me, who could companion me. And I suppose there may be places, I'm thinking about, there are social justice movements that are happening. I know you're part of that. I feel like that might be a place that young people can go. I think there need to be more spaces, and I don't say this in a self-aggrandizing way. I wish that every class at the college where I am were engaging co-learners the way they are, and they're not, because the co-learners tell me that. So I think there need to be more spaces. And I don't know. I think about spiritual community, and I think about what you call them, houses of worship or spiritual communities. Are those communities reaching out to young people in a way that would invite meaningful meaning making, and not just throwing a bunch of because that's the other thing.
No,
they're not.
No,
right?
Is the answer to the question. No, we're not.
Right.
We're doing to them the same thing we do to everyone else. Come in and be just like us. All are welcome. But right. Once you're here, could you please just be like the rest of us?
Be like the rest of us. Sit down. I just have to say, several years ago, I was teaching a course. It was, again, a first year thinking and writing course. And it was about religious pluralism and the importance of that. And I remember talking to a co-learner about a local congregation in Keene. And I said, well, you might enjoy this, I won't mention it. And he said, well, I just want to know, is it one of those places where I walk in and they're going to talk at me for an hour? And I said, uh-huh. And then I said, never mind. And because he's like, that's not my jam. And I'm like, you're right. Like, he would be welcome.
Right.
They'd jump all over him.
And could you please show up on a Sunday morning and sit down and let us talk to you for an hour?
Which is not really when most college students are up and about and wanting to be talked at. So I think about that and I think, yeah, what can we do a better job of listening? Well, that's what I mean about, we're joking about this in a way, but we're kidding on the square, because you think about college and their classes, and there's been all kinds of, scientific studies that have looked at the biorhythms and the circadian rhythms of people, of human beings. And in late adolescence, which is what college students are, their best times are probably 9 at night. They're wide awake. But they're not going to have courses at 9 because old people like me who teach them don't want to be on campus at 9. And the young people, I don't want to be there at 8 in the morning either, by the way. I teach at 2 in the afternoon. But I'm really serious. Like, you think about it, the whole course schedule is based on when faculty would like to teach, not when co-learners are the most available psychologically, neurologically, physically. And so that's just one more way of saying you people accommodate us, even though we're supposedly here to serve you. It's a mixed message. We're all about what the young people need at this college, as long as you fit into our structure, which is true in most religious congregations, right? We're so happy to have the young people. We need more of you young people. As long as you'd like to fit into the way we do church, synagogue, worship. So, yeah.
This is a great moment to invite Sarah into the conversation. With your good listening, I can tell your mind has been at work.
Well, this is fabulous, and it's very interesting that the conversation follows the thoughts and questions that I have. I was thinking, do we have the tools to encourage them to engage? And then, Leif, you started to talk about finding joy. Mm. And I thought, wow, is it that simple? I was thinking about a personal parallel about how this time in my life when, I'm kind of on the 70, looking at what does the next chapter look like? I don't know what it looks like. And this is what the kids in school are. What is the next chapter for them? They're not quite sure how to navigate that. And who is telling them? Who is telling them? I and you, and we all on this screen, have had enough years to know, oh, these are the things that you do when you feel yourself sinking into despair. You go and you make sure that you are healthy and you get enough sleep and you go find those sources of joy. And is it that simple for these kids? I think that the containers that you're making are probably very helpful to get through the day. If you look at things historically, you know, the world has been falling apart forever. And you're right, the pace right now is very different. But in the past, during the world wars, did the adults stop and say, oh, wait a minute, how are the kids feeling about this? No, they expected people to step up. But throughout those times, what was it that kept people on track? It was art and music and getting together and sharing. And the same kinds of things you're talking about right now, sharing our common humanity. So it seems, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
That's a really interesting observation, Sarah. As you were coming to the end, the phrase change and continuity was in my mind, and then you just kind of said it at the very end, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I might be romanticizing the past, but I have this image that, as you were talking about young people 50, 80 years ago, I feel like there were more forms of life in society that people could just live into that we don't have anymore. So there were structures that people could just plug into, and there wasn't this whole sense of we need to create places where we can be together. They were there. This could be a misreading of history. That could be my kind of rosy look at it. But as those forms of life, what I'm going to say forms of life, institutions, organizations, church would be among them, they've disintegrated. And so
I was actually having a similar thought. What came up for me was sort of how has the digital age contributed to a sense of isolationism, not to just lift up the digital age alone, because I think there's many factors that have contributed to that. But it does feel like that human fabric that was once tighter is, you know, getting pulled apart. Like, you know, the degradation of the earth is being mirrored in the degradation of our culture. And of course, if you think about it in that light, how could it be otherwise?
Well, and it makes me wonder what would happen if you did another version of this podcast with people who are all, say, under 25. It would just be interesting to hear what they might say or not say.
I was thinking about that, actually, that we ought to do that. So thank you for saying that. I have one other question, if I may. Sarah, did you want to follow up, though, before anything you want to react to our reactions to you?
There was just another thought that might be worth looking at, and that was you were talking, Leif, about how we expect kids to fit in. You know, we expect them to get up early in the morning and fit into our schedules. And we're beginning to realize that that doesn't really work. And I think that what's happening, at least in my head, is realizing that these kids are really looking around and saying, this doesn't work for me. This way of engaging that we're expected to do these things, this doesn't work. But it's not all only in college. It's in the workplace. And they're looking at the world and saying the way the world is not working. And we need to, I would want to see them say we need to change it. But what I hear is that they're disengaging for the moment because they're not sure how to proceed.
I think that makes lots of sense, Sarah. Thank you for pointing that out, because I was thinking too about one of the things that people have said has come out of the pandemic is this awareness of more and more people, I would just say younger adults, so maybe whatever that means, maybe under 40, saying, you know, wait a minute, there is this thing called work-life balance. I don't want to work 120 hours a week and think I'm so fabulous and never have time to see my friends or family or ski or snowboard or listen to music, whatever it is. I mean, I think that there is something to that, that shifted. And the thing is, if you're in a workplace, you might be able to say to your employer, hey, I need to do something about this. I need to have time. Whereas, and I want to say this, the co-learners I have had the space in my class, and the way it manifested was they took a lot of mental health days. Their attendance was spotty. There were many a class where half the co-learners were not there. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. If I had 18 co-learners, 9 were there. There were weeks on, I would say most classes I had 13 out of 19 or 20. They were overwhelmed, and it was what they could do. And I was very clear to say, the only thing I really ask is that you listen to your body and you meet your needs. And I have to say, I think that it's harder maybe in college for most young people to figure out, where can I exercise my power without getting, I don't want to, you know, not get credit. I don't want to get flunked out. I mean, I have many colleagues who would, I mean, the college has an attendance policy. So, okay, you miss X classes, you don't pass. So I think it might be easier in an employment setting for maybe people who are a little older or just have a little more clarity about how can I push? How can I say we need, especially if you're in a white collar position, but we can see collectively, like I know a 17-year-old who's working downtown at a pizza place making $15 an hour, which is great. But I can tell you that, you know, she said, her manager said, when I started, I was making $7.75 an hour. They're only paying $15 an hour because it's the only way they'll get a warm body in to make a pizza. Because enough people collectively have said, no, starvation wages aren't wages. No. And I think in college, there's just a little less organizing going on. But I think if there were a more collective way of college students organizing, they could make, I say to my co-learners all the time, I know you feel powerless, but collectively you have a lot of power. If 20 of you go and sit in the dean's office and refuse to move, they'll at least listen to you. I might call campus security on you, but they'll listen to you. You know, and I said, if 20 of you get up and walk out, I don't have any power to make you stay. I mean, I don't have any desire to have power over them, but I'm trying to say to them, it may seem like the professor has all the power, but we don't. You have the power. So I would say that would be nice to help. You know, that's part of what I think any of us can do is help people think about what are ways to access power, to be empowered and not to have power over and not to use power in violent ways necessarily at all. But, you know, how to say, hey, our lives matter. And yeah.
And that's a part of that, you know, emerging into the meaning making. You know, when something has happened, you've been driven to your knees either suddenly or over time, and, you know, you're down there on the ground and suddenly kind of go, hey, wait a minute. That doesn't have to be this way. You know, there is something I can do. And again, I think creating the spaces for our younger adults to, you know, be remembered to that ancient truth is crucial. And I think you're absolutely right. We do need to do this show with a couple of 25-year-olds and see what happens. So, Chris, that's next, huh?
That is next, but not yet. Let me ask you this question, Leif, just in terms of kids facing hardship, and yes, it makes sense for, in certain situations, I think, to allow the grace of, I'm too uncomfortable, I need to withdraw, mental health day, that kind of grace. I mean, it is a grace. On the other hand, and this is the question, isn't there also value in meeting a challenge, even if you don't feel like it, stepping up to that hardship? And so if you agree with that, then the next question, I think, becomes how do we help young people discern, and even ourselves, to discern one from the other, when we need to step back because we need to, or when we need to, like, that our growth really is in the direction of facing this discomfort.
Yeah, I understand that. And if I hear the question correctly, I'm hearing, you know, where's that sort of balance between attending to what we need and also showing up? Because the world needs us to show up. And what I know is that in order to show up, I have to have a modicum of caring for myself, you know, being well-rested and nourished spiritually as well as physically or nutritionally. And then that's how I can show up. And I can push myself, you know, and I'm an oldster and I don't pull all-nighters, but if I had to, I could. You know, I mean, I get what you're saying. There are times where, you know, we all are called upon to push ourselves. And I guess the question for me in there that you asked that will stick with me is how can I be of use? How can I be of service companioning younger people in figuring out that balance and finding it? And I want to say, though, that people in the classes I teach, they do show up. They do show up for each other, sometimes in profound ways. And I guess part of it is teaching us, teaching all of us, or learning, not teaching, maybe learning, how do I show up? And again, for me, it begins with listening to my body. Because I need to know the difference between a good yoga stretch that's a good stretch and what's a strain and, oh my God, I just tore something, right? And part of that is practice, 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 practice. And so somewhere there will be inevitably some sprains and some strains and some tears. But hopefully we do learn how to, you know, I'm getting better at finding out what is a stretch. One more thing someone's asked me to do, can I help? And what's the breaking point where I just scream and yell and throw things? And so I think part of it is creating, I don't know if safe is the right word, but creating spaces where people can take risks to practice that, to find out where can I, how far can I stretch? How much can I show up for someone else? And when do I need to say, like Shana just said, like there comes a point where you say, I'm spent. I got to stop now. But Shana started the conversation by saying, I don't feel well. I've got a cough. And Shana's hung in there. So it's about the both and. How do I show up and honor our limits? And we model that. So I think that's a piece of it. If we model it, that's the first step.
The mark of a really good conversation is that you have more questions and you want to keep it going. And so I, sitting with more questions, feel like we've had a good conversation, and I look forward to other opportunities to continue the conversation. Leif, thank you so much. And Shana, thank you so much for the initial conversation you had with Leif and for expanding it, for letting it ripple out. Sarah, thank you for your support of our project and for your presence today, your good listening, and your always thoughtful questions and comments.
Chris, I just, you know, thanks for entertaining this opportunity. I feel like, you know, the podcast gives me a really big stage on which to say, I told you so. Leif, thanks for joining us. This has been a truly yet another great conversation, one that I will leave with a lot to think about. And Sarah, it's always great to see you. Thank you for supporting our show. Thank you for being with us. And now, Chris, stay curious.
Go deep.
And shine light.
Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. You can join our generous donors on Patreon by going to patreon.com. You can sign up for our newsletter at our website and see amazing, beautiful, just scintillating pictures of Shana and Chris and our associate producer, Brandon Edwards. That is whatingods.com, which is, Shana?
W-H-A-T-A-T-I-N-G-O-O-D-S. This is really difficult to do that on Zoom.
It is difficult to do that on Zoom. Leif, thank you once again.
My pleasure.